You can listen to The Professional Left on iTunes, Stitcher Radio, or at our website, professionalleft.blogspot.com, where you can also contribute to this podcast. There is a PayPal button at our website, or you can mail us a letter and or contribution at P.O. Box 9133, Springfield, Illinois, 62791.
This is the podcast for June 28th, 2013. It's not safe for work.
Recorded live from just outside the studios of confirmationbias.com, it's The Professional Left with Driftglass and Blue Gal.
So what is your gut telling you today, Driftglass?
Gut is telling me that there's important stuff going on in the world.
Well, we just got back from the land of Rick Scott.
Yeah.
We had a wonderful time. We have family down there that really loves our kids, and they were fabulous to our kids, and we loved them, and it worked out great. So, but we missed our flight coming back because one of the youngest child, I'm just going to blame her.
Yep.
She had some big time tween separation anxiety and cried and cried and cried and cried and cried.
Mm-hmm.
She's going to be away from mommy for 5.5 weeks. Now, if she had been planning a sleepover with one of her friends for 5.5 weeks, she would have just walked out the door.
Right.
But this was somewhat imposed upon her, although she's having a wonderful time. I've talked to her a couple times since then. And,
yeah.
Okay, mom, I got to go now. Bye. Mm-hmm. You know? She's off with her dad and the Puget Sound area, having a great time. All three of them
having a wonderful time. Except when you call and she remembers she's supposed to be sad.
She's supposed to be sad and miss her mommy.
That's
right.
Crap.
She's 9, so it's got to be drama. If it's not drama,
why bother?
Why bother? Exactly. So,
but we missed our flight.
Mm-hmm. And that was the first time for you. You'd never missed.
I've never flown standby.
Standby.
I've never missed a flight. I've always made it to the airport.
And we did make it to the airport in plenty of time.
We did.
And then we had to hear her cry, and then we had to go through security, and then we had to hear her cry some more. So.
And then we arrived.
Actually at the gate 5 minutes before the flight was supposed to take off, and they said, no, you can't get on the plane. So.
Yeah. No, we gave your seats away. Sorry. Bye. Yeah. And I went, what?
What?
So, I'm sorry. Maybe I'm old fashioned.
We will not make that mistake again.
But here's my ticket for 2 seats on that airplane right there. Yeah. How is it that's. Yeah, I know. But that was pointless. And that's when the TSA wrestled me to the ground.
Right? No, they didn't. But we had a good customer service rep get us on another flight. And I thought it was two things were fascinating about it. One is once we got to St. Louis late, the guy at baggage handling not only had our bags, but knew exactly what flight we had been on and said, oh, so that flight's in now, and here's your bag, and we know you've been on this, and we know you almost got on this flight, but then you got on this flight, and we're sorry you had such a hard time. And I'm sitting there thinking, it's more than TSA that's tracking our whereabouts.
Bastards. You bastard. Wait a minute. No, we want that. No, oh, never mind. Okay. No,
but we want you to know exactly where we are at all times. Actually, your ticket is a contract that we will know where you are at all times.
Yes.
So, that worked out. And then on the way home, you did all the driving. You did all the driving. And I appreciate that.
I'm a man, baby.
I felt like at that hour of the night, it was important to engage your brain a little bit. And so we put on Bob and Chez.
We did. Oh, I want to move on to Bob and Chez because it was a really good show. They did a really good podcast.
They do a really good podcast. And this was liked them.
But I want to add one more thing to our return trip. It was a very good trip, and there were lots of cool things. We got to see the super moon, which
we did. Wonderful.
Super moon over Miami, but not quite, but sort of.
And
I got to recount the last time I went to Florida and had the same, you know, bore you with a story from my checkered past.
Yeah.
But since we missed our flight and we got bounced a couple of gates around, really nice customer service person who really just said, yeah, I'll take care of you.
Yeah.
And really moved heaven and earth to make sure we got on a plane and didn't have to. And she did it and she was really nice about it. And at the end of a really long day, and the storm was rolling in, everything was delayed by lightning, and it was just so we had to go. Not only did we not go to our destination, which is boring to people, but we had to sort of go around a big storm.
Mm-hmm. Yes, we did.
So where do we end up? We end up Chicago Midway. Like, really?
I thought you were going to have to get out and kiss the ground in Chicago, but
I keep trying to get out, and they keep trying to suck me back in, man.
Yeah.
So suddenly, oh, wait a minute. Hello, Chicago.
Mm-hmm.
So I waved hi to my former, I could see my house from
Midway Airport.
Where I used to live. And then we headed back down to St. Louis, which is basically a big running jump.
Yeah.
Jump in the air for 2 minutes. And
they had time to give drinks to three people on the plane.
The first four rows and the rest of you, sorry, deal with it.
Yeah.
But that was
a 48-minute flight. Yeah. So.
But it was a long night. And so let's put on a podcast. Let's listen to something engaging and fun. We put on Bob and Chez.
Yeah.
And it was a blast.
Well, I knew that you enjoy listening to them. And one of the reasons you particularly enjoy listening to them is both of them are working writers.
Yeah.
And it comes across with a lot of testosterone. So people like themselves. And so Grifcast really likes Bob and Chez.
Confirmation bias. Absolutely.
Yeah, it is confirmation bias.
I don't believe everything they say just because it comes out of their Hotmail mouths. You know? And that's not how I roll. I don't care what Rand Paul says. I don't want to gay marry them and have sex with their farm animals or something. I don't quite understand where Rand Paul's going these days.
Oh, I know.
All I know is he's a libertarian superhero.
Hey.
But they were talking about
journalism. They were talking about journalism, which was fascinating. And I think we'd like to sort of steal that from them.
Yeah.
And talk a little bit about journalism, because they were almost weeping that Michael Hastings, the late Michael Hastings,
yes,
had not been handed the Edward Snowden story
or
to actually go into the deep background of what Edward Snowden was about. Instead of releasing one piece of dry macaroni from the box of Kraft every day, which is what seems to be happening now.
Well, and him or Matt Taibbi.
And Matt Taibbi, they also mentioned Matt Taibbi would also do a much better job than Glenn Greenwald of really investigating what is going on before becoming an advocate for this guy.
And this is really...
And we're not going to shit on Edward Snowden.
No.
I don't want to even get into that. I was very grateful to hear Obama say, I'm not going to make an international case about a 29-year-old hacker. I just looked up at the sky and said, thank you. Mm-hmm.
But the two gentlemen, Bob and Chez, who I have been insultingly compared to in my own comment section, which I consider to be a compliment.
Which is hilarious.
Because, you're engaging people on a certain level who, if you criticize anything about this story or about Mr. Greenwald's handling of the story at all, if you ask, well, that's weird because that seems to contradict something you just said.
Than Bush.
You are worse than Hitler. And it just is that kind of, do you not realize how completely cult of personality you sound when you're accusing everyone else of being a cultist?
I mentioned this on an email thread that I belong to this week. I am not going to attribute to anyone's personal opinions about the NSA, about which most liberals actually agree. And that's the problem. Most people agree that our information should be kept private from the federal government and that private companies with whom we do business should not, without a warrant and without actual cause, hand over our information to the government. That's a police state. And most of us agree about that.
Yes.
But I'm not going to attribute anyone's feelings about that to how they feel about the president or how they feel about Glenn Greenwald or how they feel about Hillary Clinton, because I think that's insulting. It's insulting to me when someone says, well, you would feel that way because you're an OBOT.
You're a hypocrite.
Or you would feel that way because you still hate Obama from the primaries in 2008.
Mm-hmm.
And the fascinating thing to me is when those kind of things are hurled, very, very often, more often than not, it's about a woman.
Yeah, well, that's...
A woman must feel that way because she loves Hillary, or she must feel that way because she loves Obama, and she can't possibly have an independent political thought without having some hero worship molding her thinking.
Well,
that's bullshit.
And I know this is a dirty word. You can't have a more complicated worldview than, Obama evil, worse than Bush. And here's the proof.
Obama perfect. Yeah. And it's either or. That's your choice.
And what Bob
and women are put in that role of you must feel that way because you worship or deride someone. You worship Hillary or you worship Obama. And therefore, we can dismiss whatever you say because of how you feel about a specific politician, which is absurd.
And that is a white guy with privilege waving his dick around.
Yes, it is.
And that's all that is. There is merit to that argument, but the idea that you dismiss everyone else and the concerns of everyone else and everyone else is going to take a backseat to my goddamn issue is straight out of the 60s.
And it's someone who, as John Lewis said, has never walked in my shoes.
Yeah. And and that brings us to Mr. Snowden to a certain degree.
To Bob and Chez and journalism and the fact that it is a bunch of white guys. And I keep thinking they're all singing the same song. Julian Assange, Glenn Greenwald, and Edward Snowden are all singing in harmony even.
Yeah.
The most important person in the whole wide world is me. So the old Kangaroo song.
It's not that that's not important. It's that and what Mr. Bob and Mr. Chez were underscoring was because the story is important, it would be really helpful if an advocate journalist like Michael Hastings, who never makes any secret of his
political leanings,
or Matt Taibbi, who never makes any secret, but who doesn't act like just shit on anyone who disagrees with him and just goes hammer and tongs over the most trivial, thin-skinned, over-the-top bullshit.
On the contrary, comes back at them with more facts and what the evidence of his reporting is, rather than attributing another person's opinion to them being an obot.
And that's what
Glenn Greenwald.
Greenwald can't stop himself.
Yeah.
He, you know, the headline has to be Obama did this horrible thing. Not
the headline has to be the Obama regime.
And that's his. And he can advocate that, and he is free to advocate all that he wants. He'd write his story anyway.
But he's hurting his own story by doing that, because
he is. And that was the point. The point was you needed a real reporter. Not that you're not a real journalist, Glenn, but you need a journalist advocate like Mr. Hastings or Mr. Taibbi to go in and kick the tires, not just on the data stuff, but on the fact that, hey, didn't Edward Snowden say some crazy ass shit a few years ago and left a sort of didn't he say a bunch of stuff about starving old people and gun control and let's let old people rot because Social Security is a asshole? Didn't he say a lot of shit that's about killing leakers, shooting leakers in the balls right around the same time you're telling me that he had this heroic, you know, conscience? Isn't that the kind of thing you, as a reporter, would like ask him about before you? And even if he said it, I don't care that he said it. Isn't that the kind of thing you would want to know about?
Yep.
Isn't the kind of background of this person who seems to have led an incredibly privileged life with an incredibly libertarian Randite point of view based on the comments he left on comment threads that are still out there? He sounds like kind of an asshole.
And someone can be an asshole and still be on the side of the angels in terms of a specific issue.
Absolutely.
I don't have a problem with that.
But go ahead. Bob and Chez said words to the effect, this is the on their podcast, everybody knows this guy.
Yeah, we all know this type.
This guy's the IT genius.
Yep.
Who's
got Ron Paul 2012 sticker on his laptop. Yeah,
and believes old people should be pushed out on an ice floe to die and Social Security is a waste and we should go back to the gold standard and a whole bunch
kind of sort of doesn't like women very much.
Yeah, kind of sort of thinks that the world owes that he is the most important and most fantastic libertarian Superman on Earth.
His giftedness entitles him to a louder opinion than many, many other people.
If that's your source, that's fine. Sources are generally not angels.
No.
But you really got to be prepared for the fact that that's the guy.
People are going to shoot holes in that persona, not advocating violence, but people are going to judge him based on that kind of background and that kind of evidence.
So when your first story is about direct access, don't get dragged into because the thing is, I firmly believe that Glenn does not understand at this point in his life the difference between a journalist and a lawyer. And he keeps acting like a lawyer, as if he can just object to what you're saying and have it stricken from the record because it fucks up my case. And if he could just pound the table long enough, and if he can split hairs enough about, well, didn't you wrote a story about direct access to a server. That's a really big, scary story, except when you sort of drill down to the details, that's not really what they say. Isn't it kind of important that you not get shit like that wrong or not leave a little door open? Isn't it really important that this CNET story that fell apart?
It fell apart, yeah.
And isn't it really kind of important that you control the narrative to the point where your story doesn't suffer from those things, that you've got everything tight? And we were talking before the show, it's Woodward and Bernstein without Ben Bradley.
Yeah, yeah.
It's you need a grown-up Glenn to sit down and really push back hard on every stinking detail. And
I've asked this question several times to other people, which is, what is the Guardian's liability for what happens to Edward Snowden? Mm-hmm. And anyone, you're not going to get after Glenn Greenwald because he's a journalist for having certain pieces of information.
No.
But if there's anywhere in those email guidelines where Glenn Greenwald has pushed Snowden to get more information, or, and we don't know these things yet, and I'm not accusing anybody, but an editor, you know, Ben Bradley was always worried. And when you watch that movie,
yeah.
I'm looking at this from the standpoint of a fictionalized movie. But from what I understand of Woodward and Bernstein, look, the paper's liable for what goes in it.
Yeah.
You know, this is the thing. It has to be backed up. We have
reputation is our currency.
Yeah.
And if you go.
Just not the case anymore. It's all about who gets out there first, and we'll figure it out later. I just kind of wish Greenwald would stick to writing his stories and stay off of Twitter. I think
exactly.
It's really a dangerous place for someone who is thin-skinned and trying to defend themselves in 140 characters. Yeah, it's not a healthy outlet.
Mr. Snowden, you need to get yourself a whole bunch of lawyers.
Yeah.
And you need to stop talking to people. Mm-hmm. Secondly, your journalist friend is not your friend.
That's what I wanted to say. Julian Assange and the people that are paying for your plane flights may or may not be your friends.
Mm-hmm.
And that's a hard thing to have to admit if you're sitting in an airport in Moscow with nowhere to go.
And third, sort of directly to Mr. Greenwald, if you want your story to be taken seriously by anybody outside of your circle of defenders, please, for God's sakes, stop behaving like a jerk.
Yep.
Stop it. Just take yourself out of the story. Don't interject. Don't opine. Don't whine about people who are out to get you. Don't talk about how other people's motives are suspect and how they're hypocrites and blah, 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 blah. And make sure that the facts you are writing down are actually the facts that at a later date, someone who doesn't like you, if they throw their shoulder at those facts, they won't collapse. Because in a courtroom, you can always object and have the record stricken.
Yeah, and you have some control over what evidence is entered. On the internet, you don't.
You don't. And I think, as I've said every time, this is such an important story that you need to grow up and behave like a grown-up reporter from the 80s. Or the 60s or the 70s. And not an angry person with grudges. Mm-hmm. Who uses his stories to beat people up who you don't like.
Well, and before we move on to the Supreme Court, I do want to address the issue of that was brought up in your comment thread.
Mm-hmm.
Of, look, you guys are just complaining about Glenn Greenwald's tone, which is what you've always said David Broder did about you.
Yes. David Broder was the media.
Mm-hmm.
And people who pushed back against David Broder's – I'm a little more abstract – people who pushed back against the village that David Broder represented got shut out all the way across the board. And the only way people like bloggers ever broke through was by being loud and shrill and vituperative. And having established a long track record of being wrong about everything, it was high time for someone to call David Broder and people like him out for being partisans and power suck-ups and pretending that objective journalism was what they were practicing, when it was nothing of the sort. They were practicing stenography journalism, and whenever anything got too hot, they would just shuffle back to the corner and say, well, both sides do it,
mm-hmm.
and complain about the extremes on both ends. When you're punching down, that's one thing. What Mr. Greenwald is doing is preemptively attacking anyone who asks any questions about what he does,
mm-hmm.
and attacking them in the most incredibly bilious, angry, vicious, dismissive, sneering tone every fucking time. And, you know, as Charlie Pierce said, when you're going after Rick Perlstein, as a servant of power.
and we're face-to-face friends with Rick Perlstein, by the way.
Maybe you need to
There isn't a sweeter, more thoughtful,
more meek.
I think I could say this with him sitting across the table. He borders on the pedantic in terms of history.
He does.
And just getting it right, getting it right, getting it right. As and a that's historian, a good he, thing when you're does. Trying to write about Nixon and Reagan and all these other people, that he's a historian.
Mm-hmm.
Not not that he doesn't have a political angle. As we've said, everybody has, you wanted to mention that Matt Taibbi had an article today.
Yeah.
About everybody has a bias. Everyone's an advocacy journalist.
Yes.
You know, and that is true.
It is absolutely. And the example he gives is a really good one, which was, if I'm quoting from memory, but it's if you're writing about box scores in baseball in the 30s,
mm-hmm.
And you're just reporting the box scores and what happened, you're acting in an advocacy role because you're not mentioning the fact there's a whole lot of black players who aren't allowed to play baseball. Now, you might not even know you're doing it, mm-hmm. but you are taking a side in a larger issue.
Mm-hmm.
And that happens all the time. And there's nothing wrong with that. The fantasy that there's any such thing as an objective journalist is absurd. And he puts his biases and his preferences and his record right out there for everyone to see. But he always goes after power very carefully. And he always goes after power in a really specific adversarial way. Here's what the bankers did to you. Here's what their email said. Here's what they said, et cetera, et cetera. He never makes, as far as I know, these massive leaps from here's the facts and anyone who disagrees with me is a monstrous hypocrite and authoritarian stooge.
Mm-hmm. It sidesteps the real issue of the Patriot Act.
Yes.
Which we really need to talk about and really need to change. And anyway, we need to get down to the Supreme Court. The Supreme Court this week was busy.
Uh-huh.
And I found it fascinating that of the three cases, voting rights, Prop 8, and DOMA, they were all treated like states' rights cases.
Yeah.
And, you know, we talked a little bit ahead about how Glenn Greenwald said that Prop 8 and DOMA were imperfect, but the results were what we all wanted, except that the Supreme Court, of course, could have said, look, universally gay marriage is legal, and that's it. Federally, that's it. But they came close to that.
Mm-hmm.
The federal government has to recognize marriage, same-sex marriage, if it happens legally in one state, which is, again, states' rights. You and I had an argument at lunch today that as to whether the voting rights decision is going to backfire on the Republican Party.
Yeah.
I feel that it is going to backfire.
Yeah.
And I think it's going to backfire sooner than you think it's going to backfire. I mean, both of us agree that in the long game, the Fox Newsicans are going, as Sandy Underpants calls them, are going to die off, and the Republican Party is going to be in really big trouble. Even Lindsey Graham feels that way.
Yeah.
But I think that like what's happening in Texas with the filibuster over abortion rights, we are reaching a point of saturation where people who ordinarily stand on the sidelines have had it.
Yeah, except if they're forced to stand on the sidelines.
Yeah. Well, now there's that.
And, you know, if once again, you're going to end up with a situation where, because there's a whole bunch of people who were just revving their engine waiting for this court case, yeah. who were in Texas, who were under.
Yeah, we're like, oh, now in 2 hours, we can go ahead and do voter ID.
They were under preclearance. They had to get, and now they're like, oh, we don't have to get checked anymore. Great. We're going to put through all the shit we had up on the shelf.
Yep.
And
it's again, voter suppression of the interesting thing to me is. You know, the Supreme Court said, oh, well, the world has changed and we're not as racist anymore. And so it's OK to suppress voters who are traditionally Democratic.
Basically, yeah.
That's not racist.
Well, and you have the cases where the number of voting booths, the number of physical places to vote is 10 times higher in white neighborhood than in the black neighborhood.
Yep.
And you have voter ID laws, and you have what are essentially poll taxes,
yeah.
and you have, by the way, no more Sunday voting, by the way, no more early voting. The effect of each one of those is to chip a little bit more away at people who are traditionally Democratic voters,
mm-hmm.
and to swing the election just enough, redistrict just enough, where you can hold on to power. Because as we've learned from the last several years, all you have to do is destroy the Senate, destroy the Congress,
mm-hmm.
make sure nothing happens there, and just run all of your bullshit theocracy scams through the state legislatures.
Yep.
And just ram them through. And it's all as legal as seawater. And the Supreme Court said, yeah, go right ahead. Because your remedy, if you discover that your election has been stolen out from underneath you, is that at some point down the road you can sue, after which it's too late.
Yep. And you need money and lawyers and time to do that.
And that's,
and by that time the election's over.
And that's the goal. So at some point, yes, in the long run, there will be a backlash against this behavior. But as we were talking about over lunch today, in the long run, I don't think the Republicans care.
No, this is such a short game for them.
This is right down. If you tick off all the issues and you look at them like, you understand, right, that climate change is real and it's bad and we have to fix it. And you understand immigration is sort of like part of the lifeblood of this country and we have to address it. And you understand that women's rights and gay rights and fracking and the economy and a whole bunch of other issues really are kind of important, and they're important to the long-term health and competitiveness of our country and our world. And we really need to get on these things right now. And the answer is no, we don't. No, because all I want as an old white bigot is to go comfortably to my grave and fuck the future.
Well, and I wonder if there isn't something to human nature about that, though.
Well, there is. There is.
We often get paralyzed by thinking about the future. And I mean, I got into it with a couple of African-American women on Twitter, and I just after one tweet just walked away because they were all upset that gay people weren't talking about voting rights. I said, well, you know, Rachel Maddow was talking about it and she's gay, and Barney Frank was talking about it and he's gay, and you know, no, we blame this all on, you know, no one cares about us. No one cares about our issue.
Mm-hmm.
And so I just, when you just kind of, you can't fight, flee, you know,
no.
My point is that a lot of people, not just old white bigots, but a lot of people don't think about anything but what's on their smartphone at the moment.
That's fine. You know? But in the particular case of the old white guy wing of the Republican Party, those guys have actual political power.
Yeah.
And those are the ones who can say, we're not going to do dick about climate change until I'm dead.
Exactly. Exactly.
Well, you get to pry climate change out of my cold, dead hand. Mm-hmm. You get to pry changes to entitlements out of my cold, dead hand. We're going to keep funding my lifestyle and funding my comfort
and my tax
paying
cuts,
for my taxes and paying for my Viagra and paying for my medical bills out of your pockets until I'm dead. Then it's your problem. But until then, you're not going to touch.
And in the meantime, goddamn federal government.
Yeah. Meanwhile, you're not going to touch a fucking thing. You're not going to change anything about my life.
Yeah.
And there is behind that a sadness.
Yeah.
Because these guys miss an old time that really did exist. When things went their way. When you could basically bum around and have kind of a
you and I were talking about Mad Men.
Yeah.
I mean, there is no question at the end, and I don't want to spoil Mad Men for anyone that hasn't seen it yet. All right.
Everyone dies at the wedding. Yeah.
Right. Everyone dies at the wedding.
Yeah.
But when one of the Mad Men loses his job, there's no question that he's going to land on his feet
at all
with another full-time job with benefits someplace.
And a mistress.
And a mistress.
Yeah.
And a drink in his hand. And a car in his office.
Absolutely.
And a secretary to take care of everything.
And I talk to enough people who are old enough to be my father or old enough to be, you know, several, a full generation or half a generation older than me who were young men during a time when you could bum around, catch a ride, land in a spot, get a job, get
an apartment,
afford a place to live, afford a life. And if that didn't suit you, you just got a car, went someplace else. And there was always going to be a chair held out for you as a young white man in America.
Well, that's Louis C.K.
Yeah, always.
I'm white and I'm male, so I get what I want.
And that was
They missed that. Absolutely. It's Archie Bunker. They missed that. And
that
I don't blame them for missing that.
And the difference between missing that world and believing that it is their God-given
natural right
to have that life all the way through until their 105th birthday, when they will go to their grave on the 18th hole of the golf course that you and I will help pay for, is there's a massive difference. And because they don't understand why everyone can't live like that, because
And how much of what they got was set up for them
by
a society that supported families.
Yes. Well, and a society that built them highways and built them dams.
Highways, gave them mortgage deduction, you know, on the second home, on the vacation home.
And wiped out all the manufacturing competition everywhere else on the earth through World War II and gave them jobs. This is not to say that they weren't hardworking, that they did love their kids.
This is the problem, too, with the Supreme Court, is you have a 5-4 majority of people, including Clarence Thomas, who miss that world. They are the privileged people who are entitled to that.
And they have gotten everything. And so I understand the sadness. I understand the nostalgia, the melancholy,
Don't tell me that you worked for everything you've got.
No.
Because that's not it.
You worked plenty hard, I'm sure, but you worked hard during a time when all the fruit was low hanging.
Yeah, yeah.
And now it's not. And the idea that I've said this before, I know on several occasions, you built an ideology based on your ideal version of America. And now you're just obsessed with the fact that if we just went back to praying more and having two-parent families and having suburban white people with white picket fences, then everything
would be okay. All of that was socially engineered.
So no, you got it all backwards.
Yeah.
That was the product of this unprecedented prosperity that fell into your lap.
Yeah.
You built that out of the riches of a continent that you could plunder at will.
And we still have a society, a segment of society, the 1%,
uh-huh.
that is building an ideology that says their wealth is earned and deserved.
And the reverse. And so they reverse engineered the blame as well.
Reverse engineered what's the word I'm looking for? The marginal tax rates.
Yes.
This is because we're earning this. We built that.
But the reverse engineering, who is to blame too? Because it's not possible that they were just lucky, because that would blow their entire identity. It's not possible that they got what they got because of the subjugation of women and minorities mm-hmm. working for nothing to educate their children and run their railroads. They're not going to talk about that. It's not possible that they got what they got because the rest of the planet was wiped out in World War II and mm-hmm. they got to meet the consumer demand of a pent-up decade.
Two decades.
And they got rich off of that, and they got rich advertising that, and they got rich and not taking away from American innovation, American hard work, anything like that. They will not acknowledge that this was a unique accident
of history. Absolutely.
And therefore, somebody must be to blame for taking it away from them.
Yep.
And we're going to find those people.
And you know who it is? It's Newt Gingrich and S.D. Cupp.
Yes.
Well, I'm going to change topics again.
It's welfare queens.
It is.
It's welfare queens and liberals.
And young bucks.
And the more
and
they.
Those people.
And the more they lose, the more the angrier they get, and the more determined they are that I'm not going to pay one penny more for gas. I'm not going to support solar power. I don't want to change one fucking thing until I go to my grave in air conditioned comfort. Mm-hmm. And then whatever's left, you assholes can fight over it. That's not my problem.
That's hilarious when you're from Arizona.
Yeah, well.
Now, don't you realize you're an immigrant? You're a white guy in Arizona. Crossfire, as you said, Jon Stewart isn't gone for a month.
I know. Is
and
he gone?
CNN has decided to revive Crossfire.
Is he gone? Good.
Newt Gingrich and S.E. Cupp as the right-wing side.
I don't. Well, and,
what happened to the cycle? It's spun out of...
It's gone on to...
It was on the cycle.
Yeah, I guess it's gone on to the wrinkle-free cycle. It's now gone on to damp dry. And it's just going to spin down. It's a midday throwaway show, and it shouldn't be. There should be something there that's more substantive and more interesting.
Well, I just always, every time I see S.E. Cupp on that show, where she's surrounded by liberals on a liberal network, and she's there to get airtime so she can get a better gig, which she got with Newt Gingrich on Crossfire.
Yeah,
I just feel like she's doing Kegel exercises just to keep it all in.
Well, you know, and that'll be the Luke Russert hour at some point, I assume. So.
I assume so.
And you know, so first of all, Callista, you better stay in pretty good health, because Newt has an eye for the younger ladies, as you know.
Better double down on the Centrum Silvers there, Callista.
Well, and secondly, this is sort of saving the media a lot of money, because as you know, there's a thing that was coined by me as the Gingrich rules.
Yeah.
Which was, no matter how horribly, crazily bigoted, racist, offensive, wrong Newt Gingrich is on a Monday, by Sunday,
he's back on TV.
David Gregory will have him back on television, reburnishing his reputation, treating him deferentially, laughing at his jokes, and propping him right back up and letting him continue with his grift. And every now and then it's George Stephanopoulos or someone else who has to carry that weight. But however much Newt Gingrich shits all over himself, people like David Gregory will give him a nice tongue bath and dust him off and put him right back on the road every single time. And I don't know why that is. I assume there's money involved or a dead hooker buried somewhere that somebody knows about. I won't say which one of these I think is more likely, but it is just such an incredible sign of how captive the media is that Newt Gingrich is never going to miss a meal. But they decided to save money by that whole recycling his reputation every few months through the Sunday shows. Just give him his own show. So congratulations, Newt. You have your own show. You've got SD Cup as your sidekick. I'm sure it'll be awesome. Mm-hmm. And CNN, really, I just couldn't be more proud. Flush. You know? Yeah.
We want to talk a little bit about some local news that you may have missed, or you may not have missed, given how outrageous it was.
We had a shout out to Bob and Chez, and we should also shout out to Matt Filipovich.
Oh, I want to do a shout out to Matt. Yeah. Matt is also a face-to-face Chicago buddy of ours, although he's gotten married and moved to Boston.
He's from the neighborhood.
He's from the neighborhood, literally. And Matt is a fellow podcaster, and on his way back from Netroots Nation, he was robbed.
Yes.
Literally robbed out of his car. Two laptops, recording device, and two shows, which is a disaster given that he is very progressive and aggressive about getting good interviews at Netroots Nation. He really works hard and does the footwork necessary to get good interviews with people. And so we are so sorry that that happened to Matt. And shout out to him. I threw a few bucks his way. Anyone has a few extra bucks, we always appreciate you supporting our podcast, but this guy, you know,
he got hit
bad.
He took a hit, and he's really trying to be the new media that we're all trying to be, and
we don't agree with him on everything all the time.
No.
He's a nice guy.
Well, we have, you know, our arguments with him, this is what I miss.
It's family fight.
I really would like arguments on this side of the aisle to be family arguments. And I don't want them
and
to devolve into...
we absolutely do have family arguments with
Matt.
We do. Matt's a lot more liberal than we are, frankly.
He is. And good for him.
And
that's as it should be.
Yeah.
But we miss him and we wish him well, and we want you to...
And we hope that he recovers quickly from this loss, because it really was... Two laptops and a show and a expensive recording device is really hard to take.
Yeah.
When you're doing this for nothing. So, okay, so someone opened their pie hole in Illinois and typed it. They typed it in an email.
Yeah, somebody said that.
There's an African-American woman, Republican woman, in Chicago. Her name is Erica Harold.
Yep.
And she's Miss America, former Miss America, very attractive woman.
Republican
from Chicago, of all things.
Yep.
And apparently she has and has always had... I mean, she's not like Miss Utah, all the beauty queens who don't have a cogent thought in their head about politics. She actually has a law degree from Harvard and is smart and wants she has political ambitions. And this is what she wants to do with her life.
Right.
And so one of the they've been talking about her perhaps running for lieutenant governor. And, you know, those two elections are separate in Illinois, governor and lieutenant governor and so forth. So but she is challenging one term Congressman Rodney Davis, who is our congressman.
Yes. In the primary. I will be challenging him in the general, of course.
No,
or her, depending on who wins the primary. No, not this.
I'm not. You and I have tried to do some research on her. I'm not clear as to how she is differentiating herself from Rodney Davis. Rodney Davis is not a Tea Party candidate. He's a former assistant to Shimkus.
Yeah.
Who's a longtime douchebag.
Yeah.
Pro coal congressman.
Yeah. Yeah. And the earth will not be destroyed because
Jesus said so. Yeah.
So
this. Rodney Davis, but, you know, there have been things where I have thanked Rodney Davis for some of the stands that he has taken.
Uh-huh.
For instance, the Violence Against Women Act. He just supported it and voted for it and didn't make any kind of deal about whether or not he was going to support it or trading his vote or anything. He said, no, I'm for this. That's it. The end.
And that's what you get living in a blue state.
In a blue state. Yeah. You have to behave yourself.
You have to watch your P's and Q's.
Yeah. And just, no, that I'm not going to fall on that sword for any reason. And why would I? And
but there are, there is a strand of Republican politics in Illinois that is
nasty,
nasty, yes. Mean, yep. Short-sighted,
yep.
never talk to anybody outside of as I refer to them, the tribe that rubs shit in their hair.
Yeah.
I have no idea how offensive they sound. Mm-hmm. Are 120 years old and they run things. They don't run the whole party.
Oh, but yeah, they're leaders in the counties,
uh-huh.
of these parties. And in some cases where the county Republican Party actually does run things, because a lot of these farm communities are heavily Republican.
And so
we had this guy,
Jim Allen,
uh-huh. who is a county GOP leader in Central Illinois, who is a campaigner for Davis.
Yep. Not anymore.
No, he was asked to retire after saying, yeah. In an email. Would you like me to read this?
Please. I would.
He predicted that Erica Harold would lose to Davis and said that she would be, quote, working for some law firm that needs to meet their quota for minority hires.
Yes.
He also said that Harold is being used like a streetwalker, and her pimps are the Democrat Party and Rhino Republicans.
In all caps. Now think about this. Put yourself. You know, take a literary moment.
Yep.
And
by the way, she's a graduate of Harvard Law School.
Yeah, which Mr. Allen, I'm guessing, is not.
Is not.
But he does have a computer and a keyboard, and he does raise money and campaign for Republicans. At least he used to. That used to be his job.
They asked him to resign. Yeah. Or they asked him to retire. Yes. He agreed to retire. I don't know exactly how that conversation went, but you think it was the last scene of Mad Men.
I do.
He showed up at 9 and they'd been meeting since 7 about him.
This is not a trial. The verdict is in. You know. Can I have a return date? No.
No.
He's gone to spend more time with Chimpicus's family.
So. with the coal.
Uh-huh. Yeah. But but this is someone, remember, the backstory on these people. This is what I find fun about literature. What you can glean about human nature and about politics just from this one guy, find fascinating. Oh,
yeah. Yeah.
First of all, he's been in Republican politics for a long time. These are not opinions that he apparently hides from anyone. So up until this moment, it was perfectly okay for Jim Allen to be a Republican in Illinois. Perfectly okay for him to be sort of shoulder to shoulder, like Ken Lay and George Bush. And he lives in the 21st century with the rest of us.
Yeah.
He probably reads a newspaper every now and then, watches Fox News, might have noticed like Anthony Weiner getting into trouble by texting his junk,
yep.
and other things like that. And yet he still thought it was a really good idea to sit down at a keyboard and commit in writing this incredibly racist, offensive crap that was
racist
clearly,
and misogynist.
And it was clearly on his mind,
yeah.
as it probably has been for a long, long time.
And thought he was being
time.
Clever. Yep.
And then he hit send. He thought that was a good idea. That guy thought that was a really good idea. At the moment, sure, why wouldn't I do that?
Mm-hmm.
And they're completely unlike cases, but I would say only this about Mr. Allen and Mr. Greenwald. They don't know when to shut up.
Yeah.
They don't know when to be quiet and keep their opinions to themselves, because now Jim Allen's the story. Congratulations. Yeah. Now you're the story, because you were such a big dick and you had to put it in writing. You just had to express your little opinion. And now guess what? You're the story.
Well, and the other part of it is, to my mind, is every Republican in this country is aware, if they're listening to Reince Priebus.
Uh-huh.
That outreach to African Americans and Hispanics and women is something that in name we want to do.
Right.
And here you have an African American woman, beauty queen, Harvard Law graduate, who wants to be in your party.
Mm-hmm.
Now, I'm not saying that you can't be loyal to Rodney Davis if that's where your loyalties lie.
Mm-hmm.
But to then take your own, I mean, this goes back, they are breaking Reagan's 11th commandment over and over and over again.
Because their party is being taken away from them by those people.
By those people.
Uh-huh.
And here comes this person who they really should put on a pedestal and say, look, we are, this is our new party. I mean, Reince Priebus should find a job for this woman.
Yeah.
Immediately.
Yep. A very high-profile job.
A high-profile seat somewhere.
Mm-hmm.
And say, you know, we're here and we have this beautiful, smart, female, African-American Republican.
Uh-huh.
Well-spoken and she will. Republican.
And she will. Because everybody didn't react.
Yeah.
Everybody reacted.
Yeah. We're horrified. Everyone in the state was horrified by this. Yeah.
But
and he didn't last 24 hours after
But he
this.
And I will
but
now.
But they can't help themselves.
Well, and I'll cheat a little bit because I was at the Balloon Juice earlier today.
Mm.
And they were and there was another one of those conservatives who was like, you know, this isn't real conservatism. A real conservative is someone who is pro climate change and, you know, a real conservative or pro environment and wants to protect the environment. A real and, you know, Andrew Sullivan, a real conservative is for marriage equality. No, imaginary conservatives that exist only in your mind are that way, Andrew.
Mm-hmm.
Real conservatives. And I agree. There are people who lament the fact that Mr. Allen is in their party.
Yeah.
And people like him are in their party. But as I wrote,
but they are the silent minority.
It wasn't liberals who cooked up the Southern strategy. It wasn't liberals who invited the fundies into the party of Lincoln. It wasn't 60 million liberals who voted to reelect W.
Yep.
And then turned around to tell the left, ha ha, traitors, we won, you lost, suck it.
Yep.
It wasn't liberals who applauded W at CPAC in 2008. It wasn't.
He said
liberals.
4 more years and chanted 4 more years when he'd served 2 terms.
And it isn't
absolutely
liberals who cheer Cheney every time he sticks his head out of the crypt.
Right.
There were lots of people who warned you true conservatives for decades that there would be hell to pay someday for courting the crazies and playing footsies with paranoid bigots.
Yep.
And that day has come.
Has arrived, absolutely.
And I'm sorry if it's too bad that we can't tell the difference between the lunatics and the people who courted the lunatics mm-hmm. from this distance.
Yep.
But,
yep.
You know, you lay down with a lot of dogs, people, speaking of Ron Paul. and now you're bitching about the fleas. Well, you know, too bad. If you'd like to, this is something I told Byron York, who just didn't listen to me for some reason. he was all about, you know, if we just could appeal to minorities and do some other things. And my point to him was this. Yes, once you clean the dregs, the atavistic, yep. racist dregs out of your party, the 20 of you who are left can plan a really cool bunch of stuff.
Welcoming party, yes, for the minorities.
But
yeah.
you built this, baby.
You built this. Rush Limbaugh's beer farts. Absolutely.
And now he
cannot pivot from the racism because that's his audience.
And the people who are his audience are your voters.
Yep.
And you can play this little fig leaf game all you want. But every time you put your arm around this woman and say, look, she's one of us, you're losing 3 voters from the South.
Mm-hmm.
And every time you pivot to bring them back, you're alien and getting rid of voting rights.
And let's be clear. You're also alienating certain Democratic voters in West Virginia.
Yes. Oh, you absolutely are.
That we are equally ashamed of.
And every time you get rid of voting rights,
mm-hmm.
every time you talk about immigrants as if they are despised criminals and entire groups of people as if they are subhuman,
yep.
you cut your own throat long term. But remember, the people you're looking at don't care about the long term. They care about going to their grave in air conditioned comfort. And after that, it's your problem, Reince, not theirs.
Mm-hmm. Tell me about the new planets that have been discovered.
We have new planets. Actually, this is something that when I bring the middle child home from school or me and the boy are out driving around, we usually end up in the driveway talking about stuff, which I think is a lot of fun. And one of the things we ended up talking about one day was all the places out there. Now that you live in this century, one of the coolest things about astronomy is you're able to infer the existence of planets around stars, and the technology for inferring their existence based on how the star oscillates and the fact that it gets a little bit dimmer and brighter as objects pass in front of it, like planets orbiting it. There's lots of ways you can guess very, very accurately about the kind of planets that a star might have. remember back when the idea that other stars had planets was a big thing? Like, holy crap, really? And this didn't surprise any science fiction readers, but it was a big deal. Well, now we are getting to the point where we can infer the existence of smaller planets. They don't have to be Jupiter-sized or super-sized. They can be Earth-sized planets or a little bit larger. And according to astronomers, a bumper crop of habitable worlds has been discovered, possibly. Astronomers believe they have found an alien solar system packed with a record-breaking 3 potentially habitable worlds. New observations of the star Gliese, I'm pronouncing that wrong, I'm sure, 667C, about one-third the mass of our sun, is home to between 5 and 7 planets, 3 of which are classified as super-Earths. All 3 are larger than our own planet, but smaller than the gas giants like Uranus and Neptune. What makes all the difference is that these super-Earths are in what's known as the Goldilocks zone, the region around a star where the temperatures are just right for liquid water, a key ingredient for the recipe of life to exist, which I think is a pretty nice place to leave this podcast.
It is.
Yeah. Not that we're going to get there, because it's 22 light years away. And since faster than light travel ain't going to be happening anytime soon, it doesn't mean you can get there in 22 years. It means it's going to take a long ass time to get anywhere to the nearest star. But I have complete confidence that 10,000 years from now, human beings will be out there populating the stars. They won't look like us. They'll think we're crazy. They'll wonder what all the fuss was about. They'll wonder why we almost let the planet die. But we'll be out there, still swinging, and probably arguing about crazy shit that we in these crazy times couldn't possibly begin to understand. At 10,000 years from now, we will be the aliens. So good for us.
Each week, we post to our Facebook page and website an internet kitty sent in by you, the listeners. This week's kitty is Hecate. And at our website and Facebook page, Hecate is looking very annoyed at the intrusion into her nap time. Hecate is named for a goddess of Anatolian origins, we are told. And this goddess is sometimes associated with infernal spirits and the underworld. This cat does a good job living up to the reputation of her namesake, we are told. Hecate also has the distinction of having waited the longest to be an internet kitty. She was sent in last year and promptly swallowed up by my email. So apologies to Hecate and her owners, and we are very glad that she is this week's internet kitty. You can send your internet kitty to us at our email address, proleftpodcast@gmail.com, where you can also write to both of us. We do love hearing from you, and I will catch up on my correspondence this weekend. Feel free to write us. Be aware that if you write us at any of our addresses, we reserve the right to read your email or U.S. Postal Service, Go Postal Unions, letter on the air, unless you say otherwise. So, Driftglass, how are the internet kitties doing this week?
Well, Blue Gal, the internet kitties really, really do not want to gay marry Rand Paul.
Let's think about living. Let's think about loving. Let's think about the hooping and the hopping and the bopping and the loving, lovey-dubbing. Let's forget about the whine and the crying, the shooting and the dying, and the fellow with the switchblade knife. Let's think about living. Let's think about life.
The Professional Left Podcast is recorded under a Creative Commons license. Copyright 2013, Driftglass Blue Gal Podcast.
Minecraft is awesome. Now it's time for Science Fiction University with our science fiction expert, Driftglass.
Minecraft is awesome.
Welcome to Science Fiction University.
And first of all, our friend AR, who's written us before with some Stump the Chump questions, who's written us and donated and is just awesome to us, had a philosophical question for both of us and wants to know if we feel that the Book of Revelation falls into a fantasy science fiction category. And I think it would be helpful from the standpoint of future discussions if, for our regular listeners, you explained in very clear detail what your definition of science fiction is.
I'd be happy to. That's not my definition. It is the definition, Luga. The definitive, no, the working thumbnail genre definition that separates one pile of books at a bookstore from another pile of books in a bookstore is pretty much, as was taught to be my science fiction teacher and friend and novelist and other folks, is that if you take the science out, you have no story. And the science doesn't have to be real science. There are no things that actually travel faster than the speed of light. There is no time travel.
You're trying to tell me there's no dilithium crystals.
There are none.
That's what you're trying to tell me, and I will not hear that.
None. Trilithium, yes.
In my gut, I feel that there should be dilithium crystals.
I feel there should be too. There should be many things that there are not currently. But generally speaking, and we in the science fiction universe are very forgiving within the genre. Alternate history is perfectly acceptable. Psychological science fiction is perfectly acceptable. All kinds of general other kind of writing gets tucked in under there. There's a whole lot of magic realism that I would that, and this is where science fiction readers and aficionados and fans of a certain age and older probably are overly sensitive to the fact that when they were kids, they were told this is trash literature, you're wasting your time, it's junk, nobody reads this. What sort of idiot would read crap like that? And had to sort of justify the literariness of what they were reading to people who thought it was stupid. But Mary Shelley's Frankenstein is science fiction. And some Edgar Allan Poe is science fiction. And there's an John Swift. Parts of it are science fiction, I would
argue. And there's very good political science fiction. We haven't talked about that but in a long time. But
generally speaking, if you it's speculative, it is a speculative genre that talks about more or less the real world and not a fantasy world, not a world where dragons and magic obtain, where some trend or other is moving forward based on a glitch in history or a piece of science and a speculation about what the world would be if this keeps going on. Mm-hmm. So if you pluck that piece of science out, the whole story collapses. Or what the world would have been if certain things had been different, like The Man in the High Castle, which is one of the very good novels about Germany winning World War II. So that's generally speaking my definition of science fiction. Fantasy is a whole different matter. They're really similar. They're cousins. The best fantasy novels and stories have rules. Mm-hmm. You can't just make shit up. Mm-hmm. But by and large, it's not science fiction.
And now I'm putting on my Bible bitch hat because all this right. is a question both about science fiction versus fantasy and a question about the Book of Revelation.
Sure.
And A.R. wrote to say that she was dragged off to a Seventh-day Adventist revival at one point by a well-meaning adult as a child. And she didn't believe what they were saying, but she was fascinated by this slideshow on the Book of Revelation that it really did fall into a category in her mind of, you know, basically Game of Thrones. I mean, there's dragons, there's creatures with 10 heads and 7 horns and so forth. And there's many different ways that people have looked at that, definitely as a political allegory for whoever the author was afraid of.
Yeah.
Whether it was the Romans or the Pharisees or whatever, there's a lot of people picking it apart that way. It's just simply pure allegory for what was happening politically at the time that that person was writing.
Yes.
My dad likens it to drug-fueled fantasy. And that, you know, somebody was taking peyote or something when they were writing this and having these visions. Uh-huh. And you know, if you read that book alongside something like Naked Lunch, it's pretty easy to see the horrid visions are the stuff of drugs.
Yeah, so. but I would ask which came first.
Yeah.
Were you programmed with those kind of visions as a kid, and did they get unleashed when you're, you know, doing?
Yeah, it's hard to say. Yeah.
I do know that. During the brief stint I did with the Jesuits, one of the things that we studied, we did textual analysis of the Bible and the hermeneutics of the Bible. And one of the things they were very, very clear about was, the Book of Revelations is a political document written by an oppressed people during a time of oppression. Mm-hmm. They're writing in code about Rome and about the Roman Emperor and about the kingdoms that are around them. And if you if you look at the coins and the gates and the other symbols of Babylon and other kingdoms, they're very clearly that's what they're talking about. Mm-hmm. But you can't write about that.
Right.
So then in
you'll get your head cut off.
Right. So in Jewish revelatory tradition, the oppressed people of a particular era always cast backwards to a previous similar situation and created an allegory. So if you go back through the Old Testament, you'll find lots of revelations that were all about right now we're having our throats stepped on by the Babylonians, but we can't say that. So let's write about the Egyptians instead.
Yeah.
And we will encrypt it in a lot of shiny language and a lot of lights coming from the sky and a lot of fantastical beasts with mythical properties. But everybody knows what we're talking about, but we can't write about it that way or we'll get killed.
Mm-hmm. And I grew up among a group of evangelicals who absolutely believed in their heart of hearts that the Book of Revelation was about the Roman Catholic Church and how they're, they're satanic, and I'm going to use it against my prejudices and enemies. And that is just as silly as saying it's literal truth, as far as I'm concerned.
That's what happens. I remember when we were in some literature class or other, I was much younger, and we were talking about, what the hell was it? The Hills Like White Elephants, which is an Ernest Hemingway story about abortion. They're on a train, as I recall, they're off to, have an abortion. And I said, well, this is clearly an allegory. I think I said it was in all my 20-something pompous know-it-all attitude. This is clearly a story about the Spanish Civil War, blah, 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 blah. Or something of the rise of fascism. And my instructor gently corrected me in front of everyone that, this was written before that.
Yeah.
So that can't possibly be true. But when you leave big symbolic allegorical vessels laying around, you can fill them up with anything you like.
Oh, yeah. It's major themes that can't miss.
Exactly.
Yep.
Exactly. And so it's a fantasy novel if you want to read it that way.
And those of you that don't know that reference, we've mentioned this book several times. Harvard Lampoon's Big Book of College Life has a class listing in it. And one of the English classes is major themes that can't miss, themes so all-encompassing they cannot possibly be unrelated to any given work of fiction, including the journey, good versus evil, light versus dark, etc. So, well, let's go move on. Thank you, AR, for writing to us.
Thank you, AR.
Okay. And let's move on. And this letter that we're going to talk about today is from Mike K. Yay!
Oh, by the way,
Mike K is a...
Atlas Shrugged is the Book of Revelations for libertarians. So just so you know.
Pammy can't go to England,
Yeah, I know. I heard about that.
Okay. Because of the jihadist sympathizers.
Yeah. That's why.
What was so funny was someone emailed me the post that Pammy had written. And I said, I have gone to Pammy Atlas's blog for laughs so many times that I don't even need to click on the link. I can see the exclamation points from my house.
Yeah.
Okay.
She's a genre.
She really is. Okay.
David Brooks is a genre. She's a genre. There are people who are just like that.
Yep.
All right. So as we proceed,
Mike K is a frequent commenter at your blog.
Yes.
And an occasional commenter at my blog. And we love Mike K. He's awesome. And he has written to us with some stump the chump questions. I would like to submit a few questions as I'm shocked that no one has referred to the Polish writer and a powerful mover of early modern science fiction, Stanisław Lem.
Yeah.
Or in Polish, Stanisław Lem. And I would like that corrected.
Okay, here my score is about to go down again.
Okay. I have four questions about two fine books. And as I said to you before we did the show, I asked you if you'd read any of Stanisław Lem. And you said, you weren't sure, and you went to see what you'd read. And I'm sure that you're going to come up with, there's a Robert Heinlein story that's very much like Stanisław Lem's story.
No, but I will go, I will do Arthur Clarke this time.
There you go.
Yeah.
Okay. The first book he wants to talk about is The Siberiad.
Yeah.
Which is a modern fairy tale for a cybernetic age. Keep in mind that cybernetic has the publishing date of 1965. The story follows two quote-unquote builders, what we would call engineers, along a series of truly delightful fairy tale-like stories. As an aside, I've given this book as a gift before and would recommend that you see if you can find it for your son at the local socialism bastion, your public library. Okay.
Yeah.
Anyway, a very early story is about the builders, Trurl and Klapausius. Okay. Thank you for the pronunciation help with this, Mike, because he does provide pronunciation. Klapausius. Realize they can not only build things for themselves, but they have to build things for other people to pay the bills. However, sending letters by the postal service, go postal unions, to the myriad of planets in the galaxy would simply take far too long to be worthwhile. To the esteemed Driftglass, how do Turl and Klapausius handle this advertising dilemma?
Oh, Lord. Well, having never read the Siberian.
All right.
I will not say it's the Ansible, which is Ursula Le Guin's solution to that problem.
Oh.
A seed that I believe is an organic thing that is a translight, faster than light.
Oh.
Means of it holds her. She has a collection of stories about, I think, called the Ecumen, the sort of human empire. And since you can't travel faster than light, the way you hold it together is by faster than light communication verbally.
Oh.
By sets of radios than these particular devices. That would be my guess, but I'm
wrong. those are her ravens.
Yes, exactly. That's how
do you solve the problem of distance communication in your books? Yeah. No, the answer is fascinating. They move nearby stars to spell out their names.
Oh, see, that's
anyone looking at the stars would see their names and know that Curl and Klapausius are men of great skill. That's fascinating. All right.
That is good.
Second, as an homage to the good lady Blue Gal, to the esteemed Driftglass, when Trurl builds an electronic bard and invites Klapausius to test it, one of the poems is about a biblical figure. Standing before your beloved good Christian wife and Bible bitch, can you name that figure? And the answer is Samson. As an aside, the challenge is a poem about a haircut, but lofty, noble, tragic, timeless, full of love, treachery, retribution, quiet heroism in the face of certain doom. Six lines, cleverly rhymed, and every word beginning with the letter S. And the poem is, seduced, Shaggy Samson snored. She scissored short, sorely shorn, soon shackled slave, Samson sighed, silently scheming, sightlessly seeking some savage, spectacular suicide.
Oh,
wonderful.
That's wonderful.
All right.
Bravo.
And now on to the second book. And this is the one you mentioned. I would say Lem's most replicated contribution to science fiction was the book Solaris.
Yes.
The story of the living planet.
Yes.
For those who nitpick, the planet itself is not alive, but the entire planetary ecosystem is a single living entity. While I found the writing a bit dry, the story itself is truly exceptional. There have been three movie adaptations. The first was Russian made for TV. The second was a 1972 Russian theatrical release. However, the special effects to properly tell the story, imagine trying to do Avatar in 1970, did not exist. So this movie focused on the after effects of encountering Solaris. The modern U.S. movie by Soderbergh is actually a retelling of the Russian 1972 movie and focuses on the nature of relationships and memories. And that's the one with George Clooney that you were talking to me about. Okay. Yeah. As divergent as the two theatrical release movies are from the book, there is one conversation that is critical to the theme of all three. Among the economic factors of space exploration, when it came to discovering life, oh, esteemed Driftglass, what were we looking for?
I read the book, at least chunks of it, long time ago.
Well, this goes along.
Saw the movies.
I'm going to give you the answer because it goes along very much with what you were saying about Solaris.
I would say we're looking for things like us.
That's exactly it.
And that's the problem with Solaris.
We did not go into space to find alien life. We only sought mirrors to ourselves. Mm-hmm. A critical point is that our only concept of alien intelligence is people foreign to us.
Yeah.
We are totally unprepared to deal with an intelligence which is alien to basic notions of ours like thought, let alone perception and motivation.
Mm-hmm. And I blame John Campbell for that. John Campbell controlled an awful lot of science fiction. Mm-hmm. His magazine was essentially one of the few outlets, and he had basic rules about writing. First of all, humans always win.
Mm-hmm.
Mm-hmm. But
aliens always have knees and elbows.
Well, yeah, pretty much.
Yes.
Robots or bug-eyed monsters are basically they're intelligible to us. So we can understand them, and that makes sense from a writerly point of view. What Lem tried to do was really hard because one of the exercises I used to do when I was facilitating writing classes was don't try to do this, but try to imagine writing an entire story in an alien language with no references to anything your audience understands at all.
Mm-hmm.
And it's impossible. You could do it, but it wouldn't make any sense at all.
You wouldn't communicate anything. Yeah.
And because you're essentially, at the end of the day, you're still trying to tell a story. And the problem that Lem brings up is, and this is where I will cop to liking Arthur Clarke and writers like that. There's also an obscure little story from the 70s, I think, called the Lysenko Maze, I think that was what it was called, about a guy who develops a virus that essentially turns an entire ecosystem into one living entity that acts in its collective self-interest.
Oh,
and the thing was, you never want that thing to land on Earth. This was done in space, because one of these spores hits the Earth, boom, the entire planet is converted. Sort of like Ice Nine from Cat's Cradle.
Uh-huh.
You don't want this stuff anywhere near the planet. So the idea is there's this, how do you describe something that's alive but so different than us that we will never understand it, that it's completely out of our depth, that everything about it is incomprehensible to us? Yeah, it's clearly alive and it's clearly acting in some way that is internally consistent to its own survival. And that's a really good theme. It's just a really hard one to convey when the rules of writing for 13-year-olds, which is essentially what it was up until the 60s, was bug-eyed monsters, spaceships, robots, and sneering villains who were comprehensible to us. Mm-hmm. The opposite end of that was probably something like the Lensman series, where Kim Kinison, who apparently had no genitals, no one before the 60s had genitalia at all.
Yeah, yeah.
Landed on a planet and didn't understand what was going on there until he saw advertising. And his magic lens, the magic machine that the aliens gave us to make this sort of super police force, this incorruptible police force, translated this as, oh, you have advertising too, therefore we're similar and we're probably going to get along. Star Trek is populated by creatures that are essentially, there was a joke about that in one of the Star Trek movies, that the Federation is a humans only club.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
And it is leaving us woefully unprepared for the day when real aliens show up.
Yeah.
If that ever happens, because they're not going to be.
And they're made of gas or they're 3,000 times smaller than we are.
Yeah.
Or, I mean, that was what's the beauty of Hitchhiker's Guide was he was able to make, you know, aliens be swallowed by a dog. Mm-hmm. You know? The economy of scale there. All right. Second question. Uh-huh. Went back to Mike's letter.
Uh-huh.
And to the original book. The book was written in 1961. And it shows the protagonist. And it shows. Oh, I'm sorry. The book was written in 1961 and it shows.
Uh-huh.
The protagonist occasionally mentions carrying computer punch card stacks to different computers.
Yeah.
However, at one point he mentions that the station is new enough to have a bit of cutting-edge technology.
Mm-hmm.
What, oh, esteemed Driftglass, does this schlepping around of stacks of cards cause him to momentarily admire?
I'm guessing it's a reel-to-reel tape.
Yes. Yeah. Oh, you're good.
It would have to be.
Yep. The space station is new enough to have magnetic storage medium.
Which is
a sign that this space station orbiting a distant planet on a distant star was the bleeding edge of mankind's technical prowess, was reel-to-reel tape.
Yep.
Possibly even a hard drive, but given the time of publication, probably tape reels.
Mm-hmm.
If Driftglass tries to say that he is not old enough to know what computer punch cards are, call him out as a lying sack of poo.
Oh.
Signed Mike K. Oh, no, I knew punch tape, too.
I use punch cards.
Yeah, yeah.
I worked for a company that was on the other bleeding edge of technology. It was still trying to limp along software that had been written during the Eisenhower administration.
Oh, wow.
Literally. I mean, this is still true of a lot of companies. Down in the bowels of the mainframe, there are tens of millions of dollars, because once IT departments started thinking of themselves as owning assets,
yeah.
You had to sort of assign costs to the code you had, and code is patched over a million times.
Mm-hmm.
And so I would crack open something when I was doing maintenance on a machine and find a little flower box, which is a bunch of asterisks in a square from the programmers from the 70s, basically describing what they were doing. This is all COBOL. This was all really basic, you know, COBOL with assembler. And I could tell you stories that would curl your hair. But it was a company that was trying to squeeze every last nickel out of what it came to think of as a considerable investment in essentially a doomed technology. And they still had punch card machines. When I learned to program, we were taught, this was at the very, very ass end of that age of programming. But I still have my little plastic template for drawing flowcharts that says IBM printed across the top. I still have my pixel and point measure-er that shows you how big something's going to appear on a page. And we wrote, even though we never used them because we were way up on the 3250s. We actually typed into the machines, but they taught us to write on coding sheets, write in block letters on sheets of paper. And part of the problem with Y2K and everything else that came out of that was you had 80 characters to store a record of a person, or 133 characters in some cases. And you had to squeeze every last little bit of everything into that character length. And so you tended to truncate things you didn't need, like the 1.9 in 1960.
Uh-huh.
So,
I'm
quite familiar. I'm familiar with popping the drawer out from under the punch card machine and taking out all the chads and using them as confetti at 3 a.m. when we're up really late and something has crashed and we don't know what to do. So we decided to have a little toss that around the office. So yeah, no, I remember it well. Those were high old times. We were all going to be rich and famous, and we were going to get things called laptops and be able to program from the beach.
Yeah.
And only the most far-sighted among us thought, hey, wait a minute. If I can sit on a beach and do my work, can't that work be done at 1/10 the cost somewhere in Japan?
Oh, yeah. Yeah.
And lo and behold, that's what happened. So thanks, Mike. Thanks for rubbing that, you know, salt in the bat wound.
I'm going to say bye-bye. And thank you, Mike K., and thank you, AR, for your letters. You can send your letters, don't forget, to mrs.driftglass@gmail.com for your Stump the Chump questions. That email address is at our website as well. Okay, darling, I love you.
Love you. Bye.